Today is Wednesday, December 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the Senate passes U.S. President Donald Trump's tax cuts.
With further amendment, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is passed.
Also ahead, recent Houthi attacks against Saudi Arabia underscore a new phase in a long-running war, and we get a preview of what may be a huge musical hit in 2018. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Senate voted late Tuesday, early Wednesday morning, to overhaul America's tax system. All 51 Senate Republicans present voted in favor of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, while all 48 Democrats opposed it. Now, joining me in the studio to break things down is VOA national political correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Sure, Steve.
So, currently, the measure is once more in the House to be voted on. Can you kind of briefly explain why the House is having to vote on it twice?
The House had factors in the bill that under Senate rules they're not allowed to consider in a bill that affects the budget, spending, or taxes. So it's a technical sort of redo for the House to make sure that both bills conform under our system. That's what has to happen so that one unified bill is sent to the president for his signature. And he's eager to get it, I should add.
Yeah, so how important was this bill to be passed for Republicans and for President Trump?
Well, just moments ago at the White House, President Trump said it was a historic victory for the American people to have Congress putting its imprint on this tax cut bill. And politically, of course, we should say it's extremely important for the president. He's been short of major achievements accomplished during his first year in office. They had a real debacle on health care some months ago. So he's been pushing for months now to get the tax cut bill approved as part of his sort of delivering on his campaign promises. And they're definitely already in celebration mode at the White House and in Congress, where Republicans have been pushing tax cuts for years. And House Speaker Paul Ryan says these are basically the most significant tax cut measures that we've seen in at least 30 years.
Right. And Speaker Ryan was making the rounds across morning television shows this morning. How are other Republicans positioning this bill on media during their interviews, and what are they trying to sell to the American people?
Well, there is some selling involved because the fact is, even though they're getting this through, the polling on the bill is not very strong. In
right.
fact, between
majority
a third
Americans
and,
don't like it.
Yeah, a third and a quarter support it, but more than half don't. And as we head into a congressional election year in 2018, the question is this going to help or hurt the president and, of course, congressional Republicans? They believe it will help because it shows them delivering on the promises of what they wanted to do. But the problem is, right out of the gate, the bill starts out in kind of a deficit position in terms of polling, and that's not a great position for them to be in.
2018 is a midterm election year for Democrats and Republicans looking to redo the House, some Senate seats up. How are Democrats looking at this upcoming election cycle with this dichotomy, this disparate view of the tax bill?
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at recent election returns, starting with Alabama most recently this month, and then going back to Virginia and New Jersey in November, where it was demonstrated, at least to the satisfaction of Democratic strategists, that the key issue they can frame is President Trump and whether or not he's popular with the American people. We know he's struggled in the polls all year, continues to be in the mid to high 30s at this point in terms of public approval. That is not good in terms of presidential approval and could signal that Democrats are hoping to build a wave of support in 2018 that could carry them at least to gains in the House and Senate. Some are even hoping for, you know, a takeover, control of either the House or Senate, or perhaps even both in a long shot.
All right. Jim Malone is our national political correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure.
All right. Now, also joining me in the studio is our social media correspondent, Andrew Palcheski.
Welcome. Good to be here with you.
Yeah, so speaking of social media, what are people saying online about this tax cut?
Well, it really echoes the national sentiment that Jim was just talking about, that a majority of people on social media are very unhappy about this bill. And in fact, the trending hashtag today is hashtag GOP tax bill scam, as people talk about how it will benefit the wealthy and harm health insurance. There's been a lot of talk about certain tax provisions in states like New York and California that will be rescinded as far as deducting property tax. And there's a lot of anger that Congress passed this plan while still failing to pass legislation that funds children's health insurance programs that are set to expire. The flip side of this, of course, is that Republicans are defending the bill, saying that by February, people will begin to see the tax savings, and once they do, the support will grow. Certainly, as Jim mentioned as well, Republicans want to see that support grow by November's congressional elections. And among the top Republicans talking about this is the top Republican, President Trump, tweeting out that the results will speak for themselves. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's something that they've been hammering home, that this will really spur job growth and will help people. But it remains to be seen whether it will or won't. And we'll have to wait a couple months, I guess, to find out.
A big topic online. Anything else trending this hour?
Yes, a bizarre story that with the Senate voting last night on this bill, comedian Rosie O'Donnell tweeting out that she would offer $2 million to Senators Jeff Flake and Susan Collins to vote no. A lot of people quickly noting it is illegal to offer any kind of elected official money. It constitutes a bribe. So a lot of talk about that, whether she was joking or whether this was an actual offer and if she'll face any consequences.
And we'll have to follow up on that. Andrew Palczewski, our VOA social media correspondent, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
Thanks, Steve.
Among other top stories in the world, members of South Sudan's many warring factions are gathered at a forum in the hope of working out a ceasefire as soon as Friday. The European Union's top court ruled that Uber should be regulated like a taxi company and not a technology service. It's a decision that could change the way the company functions across many countries in the continent. And the United Nations Special Human Rights Envoy to Myanmar says the government is barring her from visiting the country to assess the current situation in the East Asian nation. These stories and more are at voanews.com 24 hours a day. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from two American universities have uncovered new evidence that suggests life in the universe may be more common than thought. The researchers analyzed a diverse collection of microorganism fossils they've confirmed to be nearly 3.5 billion years old. At that age, they would be the oldest fossils found so far. The researchers say their analysis revealed that two of the microorganism species seem to have carried out an ancient type of photosynthesis. Another produced methane gas. And it appeared that two other species ingested and used methane to build their cell walls. Researchers say their newfound evidence of the evolution of a variety of organisms during Earth's early history, coupled with the countless number of stars and planets that orbit them, supports the growing understanding that life can exist throughout the universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman denied the country supplied weapons to Yemeni Houthi rebels in its nearly three-year conflict with a Saudi-led coalition and insisted that Tehran has no arms link with Yemen. The denial followed Tuesday's latest attempted missile strike from Yemen on Saudi Arabia's capital. It was destroyed by Saudi air defenses with no reported casualties. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal told VOA's Victor Beatty there is no definitive proof that the rocket came from Iran, but he said the rebel missile attacks, the stepped-up pace of Saudi attacks in Yemen that has killed nearly 140 people since December 6th, and the death of former President Ali Abdullah Saleh underscore a new phase that their conflict has entered.
What I'm afraid of is this, that if the Saudis retaliate, which they seem to have retaliated since the missile attack, it will lead to more civilians being killed there in Sana'a and other parts of Yemen, which that would mean that any sympathetic protection and support that Saudis could possibly be getting out of their own efforts and attempts will likely fail. And they may be forced into once again retightening their sanctions and control on imports of essential goods and services into Yemen, which then will again create more retaliation at a time when there is no visible organized support for the Saudi position in Yemen at this moment, with even the Saudi-supported government of Mr. Hadi Mansour is sort of lying low and taking it easy. So this is a bit of a dangerous time. The question is, if the Saudis don't react, the Houthis will consider this as a sign of weakness. Remember that these missiles, they have been stockpiling for a long time. Many of them have actually been bought during the 1990s from the North Koreans, and they have been, quote-unquote, refurbished and adjusted to the new circumstances and conditions. So my worry is, any tit for tat is not good for either of the parties. And it could really get to a situation where other countries in the region may start to be worried and disturbed about the pace at which things could very well get out of hand. The point, therefore, is find a solution and some rapprochement between the two of these. It doesn't look that great at this moment, but we have to try and make an attempt.
The U.S.-UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, said the latest missile strike bears all the hallmarks of previous attacks using Iranian-provided weapons. So the question is Iran becoming more deeply implicated in this conflict?
That particular part is really not completely assured. What we know from the local press and the local grapevine in the region, it really wasn't an Iranian-supplied missile. The trouble is this, that the technology used by both the North Korean-based and Iranian-developed missiles is practically the same. It's very hard to tell as to who is actually providing this particular weapon and where is it coming from, number one. Number two, more important issue is, what does it matter as to whether it has come from Iran or it has come from elsewhere? They have a stockpile, and they're going to use that stockpile. They have got an upper hand ever since Saleh has been killed. What do we do under these circumstances? Do we keep playing the same game over and over again? Do we keep blaming them and thinking that they will blink? I doubt it very much.
Zubair Iqbal said a new approach is needed to end the cycle of violence and said the United States, in coordination with Europeans and perhaps China, should step in to offer a face-saving compromise for both sides. Meanwhile, Yemen's humanitarian crisis deepens, with the United Nations warning 18 million people are in need of food aid, including many described as being on the brink of famine. The Saudi coalition Wednesday said it will keep the port of Hodeida open for a month to allow in humanitarian aid. A survey by the UN Refugee Agency reveals heightened worries by the Rohingya refugee population in Bangladesh over their health and safety. Lisa Schlein reports from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
It has been nearly 4 months since the mass exodus of Rohingya refugees began from Myanmar into Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. More than 645,000 Rohingya who escaped violence and persecution in Myanmar are living in squalid, overcrowded settlements. A survey by the UN Refugee Agency and 13 other organizations finds the refugees have developed strong support networks to help them cope with their difficulties. The UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic says the refugees have many worries. They express concern about their safety, considering their weak shelter accommodations and poor lighting at night.
Access to sanitation is still insufficient, leading sometimes to long queues for latrines. Women and girls are anxious about the shortage of private bathing spaces, forcing some to wash outside their shelters in early morning hours.
The survey finds some children have to walk long distances to fetch water and firewood, a situation that can put them at risk. Mahecic says both parents and children want access to education and more safe places for children to play. He says health services also are a major concern.
Increased mental health support for those who have witnessed the killings or suffered torture or rape remains crucially needed. Refugees cite continued feelings of depression and rejection, especially among the elderly and disabled. Many young people are worried about their uncertain future.
Mihecic says the UNHCR will use the survey findings to improve the protection and assistance programs for the Rohingya in the coming year. He says the agency already has begun providing alternatives to firewood to address child labor and environmental concerns. He says efforts also are underway to improve the hygiene and sanitary conditions for women and girls and to provide more child-friendly spaces where boys and girls can play in safety. Children account for more than half of the refugee population. Health officials say the refugees are extremely vulnerable to diseases as they have low vaccination coverage and are living in congested, unsanitary settlements that are breeding grounds for infectious diseases. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The United States and Canada said Tuesday that nations from around the world would convene January 16th to show solidarity against North Korea's nuclear program. Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland said the meeting would take place in Vancouver.
We will use this gathering as an opportunity to advance our work on diplomatic efforts towards a more peaceful, prosperous, and nuclear-free future on the Korean Peninsula, and to demonstrate international solidarity in our condemnation of North Korea's actions.
Wednesday, South Korean President Moon Jae-in said he has asked the United States to consider delaying joint military exercises until after the country hosts the Winter Olympic Games in February as a way to ease tensions with North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs. Mr. Moon said the U.S. is reviewing the proposal, but U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said he was unaware of any plans to halt such exercises. And China and Russia have called for a so-called dual suspension, freezing the joint exercises while North Korea freezes its testing. VOA's Border Crossing host Larry London recently sat down with International Edition's Sarah Williams. They discussed a new album that's dropping next month, and Sarah started off the conversation by asking Larry to introduce the artist.
We're going to be talking about a 21-year-old singer who was with a band called Fifth Harmony, but she's left to go out on a solo career. Her name is Camila Cabello, and she's releasing her debut album on January 12th. It's called Camila. It wasn't always called Camila. There was a lot of talk that the album was originally named The Hurting, The Healing, The Loving. I met Camila. I spoke with her, and I asked her why she decided to change the name of the album. She said because she wants to heal from the hurting, but she can't as long as people keep asking her about the album title and about all the hurting that she needs to heal from, some of which is related to the fact that she left the band that she had started with, Fifth Harmony. They were discovered on X Factor TV here in the United States and had a number of big hits, but she felt she was being sexualized in that band and doing what they were doing. So she just didn't, you know, want to continue in that direction. She said her own music, her own style, very different. Plus, she's always had the dream of being a solo artist. So here she is now. She's a solo artist. So we're going to check out her latest hit, which this week is at number 3 on the Billboard charts. For several weeks, it had been at number 2, but it's still the most played song on the radio, according to Billboard. And it's called Havana. Here's Camila Cabello.
Havana, Havana. Half of my heart is in Havana, ooh, nah, nah. He took me back to East Atlanta, nah, nah, nah.
Now, does this partly arrive from, because I believe she's from the Florida area?
Yes, she's from Florida. Her family ancestry is from Cuba, so the song has some very personal meaning to her. A lot of people discouraged her from going with that song off of her album. They thought this would be an appropriate song. It's very regionalized, very targeted. It's very Latin in flavor. It's just, you know, let's not go there. Let's go with something else. She defied everyone's recommendation. She said, no, this song is something I want to release. So she did. And it has been her biggest hit to date. And she's had several other solo songs out. She had a couple of duets that she had released. And, of course, she's got all the success that she achieved with Fifth Harmony. But she said with her new album, her debut solo album, Camila, she wasn't after fame. She wasn't after chart positions. She said it was just something that she wanted to do for her fans. And it was important to her that this be embraced by her fans and those that support her. So that's what she did, and she stuck with it. So Havana's been very successful for her. She's going to be performing New Year's Eve in Times Square on the ABC TV show, The Rockin' New Year's Eve Special. So she's got a lot of big things planned for 2018.
You got a lot of visibility from that.
A lot of visibility. She's had some friction with her former bandmates. She, you know, has tweeted out before, hey, it's time to mature and grow up. They were on stage at a recent award show. I think it was the American Music Awards show, and they put a cardboard cutout of some figure. Wasn't sure if it was Camila or not, but, you know, she's the one who left the band in January. So then they pushed it off the stage, and they've said they have no intention of replacing her. Now they're down to four members, but she's off on her own, and the other girls in Fifth Harmony also say they're going to continue to be a band, but they're also going to explore some solo stuff. So that's what's been going on with Camila Cabello.
All right, thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
And that is going to do it for today's program. I'd like to thank Patrice Martin for directing today's episode, as well as Cornelius Tenner for engineering the broadcast. And most importantly, I'd like to thank you for listening. Be sure to follow The Voice of America on social media. You'll find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where we post pictures, stories, videos, and more. In Washington, I am Steve Miller. Have an absolutely fantastic day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The newly implemented U.S. strategy in Afghanistan is turning the tables on the Taliban. The new policy announced by President Trump in August has shifted U.S. military operations from a time-based mission to one that is now conditions-based. As General John Nicholson has stated, we will be here until the job is done. During a recent briefing, Air Force Brigadier General Lance Bunch explained that a newly developed sustained air campaign is targeting the Taliban in their so-called safe zone, command and control nodes, illicit revenue-generating ventures, and their logistical networks. Since November 20th, the U.S. military, along with Afghan defense forces, have eliminated 25 narcotics processing labs from the Taliban inventory. This equates to almost $80 million of drug money eliminated from the kingpin's pockets, while denying over $16 million of direct revenue to their Taliban partners. The Taliban have never had to face a sustained targeting campaign focused on disrupting their illicit revenue activities. And it's not over, said Brigadier General Bunch. In fact, it's only just begun. And this will be a very long winter for the Taliban, as we will continue to disrupt their revenue sources again and again and again. Prior to the policy shift, U.S. forces could only train, advise, and assist the Afghans at the core level. But the new South Asia policy will allow U.S. forces to embed with Afghans all the way down to the battalion level. Coupled with the air interdiction campaign, the strategy will allow Afghan defense forces to keep pressure on the Taliban through the winter. As for the Taliban, they have fared poorly in 2017. Indeed, they have been unable to take a provincial capital or even a single city, said Brigadier General Bunch. They underestimated us, and they underestimated the will of the majority of the Afghan people, 87% of which believe the Taliban is bad for Afghanistan. Together with our Afghan partners, said Brigadier General Bunch, we are on the path to victory. We are working to achieve a negotiated settlement, to reduce violence to manageable levels, and create a safe, secure, and prosperous Afghanistan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.